Sure, they aren't living the high life, but they aren't here begging at the door either. Times are tough. Times are hard. Kick their asses out of the yard. Sarge smiled at his little rhyme. Sheffield was shaking his head. You really are a mean old bastard, aren't you? You got any compassion for people? Sure I do. Plenty of it for people who help themselves. But I can't spare a shit for those who won't. That's what was wrong with our society before things went to hell. Too many people thinking they were entitled or owed something just for being born. The only thing each of them is owed is the chance to try. Sarge stood up. Hell, this was probably the best thing to happen to this country. If we come out of it on the other side, we'll be better for it. The playing field's been leveled. Everyone pretty much went back to square one. Not everyone is set back to zero. Your buddy Morgan and his friends got all sorts of stuff most people don't have. He didn't have to start from scratch.
Because he planned ahead.
And you really have no idea the kind of shit he went through just trying to get home to his family. When he showed up at my place, he was nearly dead. But he ain't sat around on his ass, crying poor mouth. He's out there making a go of it. Everyone over there is. Hell, they've got quite the little community going on now.
He's right, Captain. Plus, we've got orders, Livingston said.
So you want to put everyone out? You're taking his side? Sheffield asked.
I'm not taking sides. It's just a simple fact. Our obligation is to maintain our force and provide security. I don't think we should be responsible to take care of everyone.
Hell, half these people around here don't want to lift a finger now. The DHS made them work, so they did. But now that we're here, and not pushing them around at gunpoint, they aren't so keen on helping themselves or helping us help them.
Did they give you any reason for closing the camp? Sarge asked.
Their reasoning was pretty simple.
They can't provide enough supplies to us to support a few hundred refugees. The colonel said now everyone is essentially a refugee, so people are just going to have to take care of themselves.
I don't agree with it, but that's what I got.
So where are you guys going? Sarge asked.
Back to the armory. They want us back there as soon as we can manage, Sheffield replied.
Sarge stared at the floor, nodding, thinking it over.
So I assume they have some sort of plan for you guys?
Yes, they do, but I don't know yet what it is. I was just told to get moved and stand by.
I can hardly wait to hear what it is, Livingston said sarcastically.
Well, for what it's worth, I agree with them. These folks need to take care of themselves. You can't do it for them, Sarge replied.
What do you think these people are going to do?
Where do you think they're going to go? Some of them are from as far away as Gainesville.
How are they going to get back? Sheffield asked.
Again, not our fucking problem. They'll have to figure it out.
If it makes you feel better, load them up with some supplies, food, water, and the like. Then it's up to them, not us.
Sheffield's face flashed with anger.
We'll worry about this later. Right now, we've got a job to do, so let's get to it.
The three men left the office to find Ted, Doc, Mike, and Jamie hanging out around the Hummer out front. Sarge and crew got in theirs while Sheffield, Livingston, and Jamie got in the other. Mike followed Jamie as she drove through the camp.
This should be fun, Ted said,
riding in the back with his elbow propped on the open window.
I just hope it goes smooth, Mike replied.
It'll be all right. If they start any shit, putting a couple of them in the dirt should take care of it, Sarge added.
The Hummer stopped in front of a couple of tents ringed by guardsmen. Four buses sat off the main road into the camp, doors open, with their drivers and security milling around. There were also two Hummers, one in the lead and one at the rear of the column. Both of these had belt-fed weapons mounted to their turrets. Sheffield stepped out of the Hummer and looked around. Seeing Ian, he called him over. As Ian approached, Sheffield asked, "Everyone ready?" Ian nodded. "Sure thing, boss. We've broken them up into four groups. The guys at the bus will cuff them up with flex cuffs as they get on." Sheffield nodded. "Do they know what's going on yet?"
"They know something's up, just not sure what."
"You pass the rules of engagement along?" Livingston asked.
"Everyone's clear."
"What's the ROE?
Sarge asked, as he came up to the group. Sheffield looked at him.
"No shooting unless absolutely necessary. That applies to you guys, too." He pointed at Mike, Ted, and Doc.
"No worries, boss man," Mike said with a grin.
Doc held up his hands and mocked surrender.
"All right, Ian, get the first bus up here, and let's get 'em loaded," Livingston said.
Ian nodded and turned to face the buses. Whistling, he waved an arm at the lead bus. The bus quickly began to move up toward the tents, where the DHS personnel were being guarded.
"I'm going to sit here and enjoy the show," Sarge said, as he leaned back against the hood of Sheffield's Hummer.
Jamie followed Ian to the tent, where Perez and several guardsmen stood at the entry.
"All right, Perez, let's get the first group out," Ian said.
Perez nodded and opened the door, telling one of the soldiers inside to bring out the first group. The soldiers outside formed a loose cordon to the door of the bus. Soon, the DHS folks were walking out, looking unsure of what was going on. The lead agent asked the obvious question.
"Where are we going?"
"Don't worry about it. Just head for the bus," Perez said.
"This is bullshit. Where are we going? What's going on?"
Soon they were all shouting questions. Sarge was grinning as he watched the proceedings. The old man looked over at Ted.
"Teddy, go get them bastards moving."
Ted and Mike quickly started to move toward the action.
"Roger that, boss."
"What are you doing?" Livingston asked.
"LT, this shit is going to take forever if we don't get them moving. They just need to know you guys are serious."
"We said no shooting," Sheffield said, pointing at the knots of civilians that were still gathering to watch the proceedings.
"We can't risk a firefight with all these people around here."
"Don't worry, Captain. They aren't going to shoot anyone. Yet."
Sheffield and Livingston both looked back to the bus, unsure of what was about to happen. As Ted approached, he heard one of the DHS agents.
"We aren't going anywhere until we know what's going on. Where are you taking us?"
Ted stepped through the soldiers.
"Shut up and get on the bus. It's the only time I'm going to say it."
The agent looked at Ted.
"Or what?"
He was cut off by the pop of Mike's taser. The agent immediately went rigid and fell backward. None of his fellows bothered to catch him. They actually stepped aside, allowing him to hit the ground.
"Anyone else want to know what's going on?" Ted asked.
The suddenness of the action startled the other agents in line, their only reply the silent shaking of their heads. Ted pointed to the stricken agent.
"Get him on his feet and on that bus."
Ted looked at Mike.
"Leave those in him until he's cuffed up."
Mike looked at the man he'd just tased.
"Let's go, princess."
Without any further complaint, the agent moved to the bus, where the security personnel secured his hands behind his back with the flex cuffs. The others were all likewise secured, and the bus was quickly loaded. It pulled forward to allow the next in line to pull up, and the process was started again with the next bus. Sarge was laughing to himself.
"Told you, boys. He didn't shoot anyone."
Neither Sheffield nor Livingston replied. They simply watched as the next two buses were loaded without any further incident. The fourth bus pulled up, and the process was started for the final time. This one would carry the officers and any deemed troublemakers. Early on, they had been segregated to keep them from instigating any trouble with the rank-and-file agents. Charles Tabor was the first to come out. He looked around, scanning the crowd. When his eyes landed on Sarge, Sheffield, and Livingston, he was incensed. Sarge tipped his hat sarcastically as Tabor waited to be cuffed up, his trusty sidekick Ed right behind him. Next up was Singer. When she came out, Jamie patiently waited for her opportunity to make eye contact. As usual, Singer had that same miserable look on her face, as though she perpetually smelled shit. Jamie shook her head. What a miserable bitch, she thought. Singer squinted against the intense afternoon light. When they locked eyes, a slight smile cut Jamie's face as she winked at her. Singer's sneer morphed into a snarl of sorts, which only brought Jamie more pleasure. As these priority prisoners were being led toward the bus, Calvin and Shane walked up to where Sarge was reclining against the front of the Hummer.
"How's it going there, Linus?" Calvin asked.
"Fair to middling. How's the ribs?"
"Getting better. Would be a lot better if I were at home, though." Sarge stood up.
"I was going to ask why you're still here. I thought you'd be long gone by now."
Calvin nodded toward Sheffield, then replied,
"They told us we were free to leave, but it's a long walk, and in my current condition, it's just not possible. Plus, we don't have any weapons. Ours were confiscated when we came in here, and now they've gotten mixed in from when they did the inventory a few weeks ago," Shane added.
Sheffield let out a long sigh, exasperated.
"I'm sorry. I told you guys I don't have the manpower right now to go checking for your specific hardware. Like I said, as soon as we get rid of these guys, I'll see what I can do."
As they were talking, a group of four civilians moved toward the front of the bus. Livingston saw them and called out,
"Jamie, get them out of there!"
Jamie approached them, pointing her weapon in their general direction.
"Move away from here now, please," she said in a stern voice.
The four men looked at one another and began backing away. Jamie turned her attention back to the last group to be loaded. When the first of the group was about to be cuffed, Tabor shouted,
"Now!"
The group suddenly erupted, each of them grabbing the nearest guardsman and trying to take their weapons. Jamie quickly moved into the fray, striking one man in the face with the butt of her M4. She was tackled from the side, going down hard. Out of the corner of her eye, she could see that sneer in the red hair. At the same moment, the four civilians who had been ordered away from the bus broke into a sprint, running toward the brawl now taking place. Sarge stood passively, analyzing what was going on. He saw the four men running toward the melee. Calmly drawing his .45, he fired an offhand shot at the lead man, striking him in the abdomen. The man crumpled on the ground, his comrade, who was trailing behind him, falling on top of him. The other two paused for a moment, the shot catching them off guard. Looking around, they saw Sarge, pistol leveled at them. Hesitating for a moment, they looked at each other, and then turned and took off at a run, leaving the other two behind. Shane and Calvin were stunned by the suddenness of what was going on. At the bark of Sarge's pistol, Shane looked over to the two men on the ground, one obviously wounded, the other getting to his feet.
"Son of a bitch!" Shane shouted.
Sarge looked at him.
"What?"
Pointing to the man getting up, Shane shrieked,
"He's one of them!"
It was Niigata, unmistakably, even though he was wearing civilian clothes. Shane's face twisted with hatred at the sight of his torturer. Sprinting up to him, Shane went to deliver a kick. It was a clumsy effort, which Niigata caught, raising Shane's leg over his head and delivering an open palm strike to Shane's groin. Shane let out a groan and fell to the side. Taking advantage of the hit, Niigata started to rise to his feet. But before he could stand upright, another shot rang out, and the dirt between his feet erupted. Niigata looked down, then up, to see Sarge, holding a leveled pistol at him. While confident of his skills, he knew there was no way he would outrun a bullet. Niigata surrendered, raising his hands and lowering himself to a kneeling position. The sound of the shots caused alarm, increasing the intensity of the fighting. Jamie was now on her back with Singer on top of her. Tabor and Ed had one soldier on the ground, trying desperately to strip his weapon. Mike and Ted leapt into the fray, making their way toward that scuffle. Ted shot Ed in the neck with his taser, dropping him to the ground. Coming in at a run, Mike kicked Tabor in the face, a crushing blow that threw him onto his back, unconscious. Singer was delivering a fusillade of closed-fist hammer blows to Jamie's face. Jamie was trying to fend them off, but darkness was closing in around her. She couldn't get her weapon up because Singer was sitting on it. As a last resort, she reached for the knife attached to her body armor. It had been a gift from her dad, a nice Bark River Recon. Many a deer and hog had been skinned with it. As she drew the knife, there was a sudden pause in the assault. Jamie didn't know that Ian had stepped in and grabbed Singer by the hair, wrenching her head back. Seizing the opportunity, Jamie thrust the blade as hard as she could with her right hand into Singer's ribs. Singer let out a yelp, looking down at Jamie with wide eyes. Jamie pulled the blade out and thrust it into her ribs again. Singer was pulled off by Ian as Jamie lay there trying to catch her breath. Her face was on fire, and she could taste the blood running down the back of her throat from what she was certain was a broken nose. She coughed, and a splatter of blood covered her chin. Ian rolled Singer over and quickly cuffed her. Once secure, he dropped down beside Jamie, cradling her head. Then he saw the knife and the blood. "You're going to be all right," Ian reassured her, then called out, "Doc!" She didn't reply to say she wasn't hurt. Even the effort of breathing hurt. Doc was quickly at her side, checking her over. Seeing the knife on the ground, he started looking for wounds, but only found fresh blood. "Jamie, have you been stabbed? Are you cut?" he asked, as he undid her armor. Rolling her head to the side, she spat a slug of blood into the sand. In a garbled voice, she replied, "It's not me. It's her. I stuck that bitch." Doc stepped over to Singer and rolled her over, but it was obvious she was dead. Doc left her and returned to Jamie, who was now trying to sit up. He started wiping the blood from her face, but Jamie pushed his hands away. "I'm fine, Doc. Let me just sit up." "You think you're fine? Let's get you up." While Doc worked on Jamie, the rest of the prisoners were being secured, the fight having been quickly put down. Tabor and Ed were lying face down in the sand, side by side. Mike and Ted jerked them to their feet. Sarge led them at gunpoint to the door of the bus. As Tabor approached the door, he asked with a heavy voice, "Where are we going?" His upper lip was split in two just right of center, which gave him a grotesque look.
"When the bus stops, you'll know,"
Sarge replied with a smile.
"What do you people think you're doing? What do you think you're going to accomplish?
You had these people living like prisoners. You should be ashamed of yourselves, acting as if you were higher than God. I guess if you think you're the solution to cleaning up this mess we're in, then maybe the government isn't the answer to everything. What'd you guys think you were going to do? Lock everyone up? You can't cage the entire country."
"This ain't over yet. I'll be seeing you again," Tabor spat.
Sarge smiled.
"Every boy needs a dream, and I hate to squash dreams, but
I'll make an exception for you. This is over, sport, and somehow I don't think we'll ever see each other again.
Tabor glared back in response. Sarge looked at Ian.
This one here needs some cuffs.
After Tabor was cuffed and led on the bus, two guardsmen brought Niigata over. As Ian was cuffing Niigata, Sarge looked at him.
So what's your story? What'd you think you were going to accomplish?
With great effort, Shane managed to walk over to the bus and instead answered Sarge's question.
He's their interrogator, and he's a piece of shit, too.
Sarge looked at him.
Well then, looks like you're getting on the bus, too.
Nothing more than an inconvenience, Niigata replied, then looked at Shane. I'm sure everything will work out, one way or another.
Shane spat into Niigata's face. He smiled.
And here I thought you and I were friends.
You're lucky I don't kill you, Shane replied.
I'm sure it wouldn't be that easy.
Sarge raised his pistol and put it against Niigata's temple.
Wanna bet?
Niigata glanced sideways, but said nothing.
Lower the pistol. This is done,
Sheffield ordered.
Sarge raised the muzzle. Guess we'll have to wait and see.
So it would seem, Niigata replied.
Get them on the bus, Sheffield ordered.
Once the bus was loaded, Sheffield walked up to the officer in charge of the security detail.
Thanks for taking them off my hands.
Oh, you're welcome. Now I've got to deal with them. They should feel at home once we get them there,
he replied with a smile. Sheffield smiled.
Better you than me.
How many of them are there in Frostproof?
Oh, there's a ton. They've been consolidating from all the camps.
Originally, they were holding them at MacDill, but now that we've taken over the camp at Frostproof, they're shipping them all there. It's one of those FEMA camps that everyone used to say didn't exist. You know, I used to hear about those things, and I was one of the people always saying it was all bullshit. He shook his head. But I can assure you, it's all true.
So what's the plan for them? Sheffield asked.
Shit, like I'd know.
You're a captain, and you're asking me?
Sheffield laughed.
Guess you've got a point.
Thanks for taking care of the situation, and thanks for the supplies you brought.
Well, I was told to tell you, there won't be any more.
I appreciate it anyway, thanks.
The officer stepped up on the side of the Hummer. Giving a loud whistle, he twirled his hand in the air to signal the convoy to pull out. Everyone watched as the buses and Hummers drove toward the gate.
Damn, I'm glad they're gone. That was a shit show, Livingston said, giving voice to what everyone else was thinking.
We're going to take Jamie to the clinic to check her out, Doc said, as Ian helped her get in a Hummer.
She all right? Sheffield asked.
Yeah, she just took a bit of a beating, Doc replied.
Sheffield looked over at Singer's body.
Who shot her?
No one. Jamie stuck a blade in her.
I know I heard a shot, Sheffield replied.
I shot one of them civilians that was rushing in to help them, Sarge said.
What? What civilians? Livingston asked.
Remember them ones that was getting close to the bus you told them to back up?
Livingston nodded.
When the fight started, they tried to rush in, so I put a round into one of them.
You didn't even see them, did you? Sarge replied.
Sheffield looked around.
Where's the body, the guy you shot?
One of his buddies helped carry him off, Sarge replied.
Sheffield turned to Livingston. Get a detail together to find them. Livingston nodded.
Hey, Perez, get some guys and find the civilian who's been shot.
Perez nodded and waved at a couple of the guardsmen. Mike and Ted walked past Sarge, telling him they were going to the clinic to check on Jamie. Sheffield turned to face Sarge. Jabbing his finger at him, he shouted,
I told you, no shooting.
Did you even see those guys coming in? Why didn't you know one of them was DHS?
He was hiding here, right in the midst of you people, and you had no idea.
Sarge shot back.
A gun isn't the answer to every problem.
Quite to the contrary, Captain. It's been my experience that pulling a trigger usually takes care of the problem permanently.
Sheffield shook his head in disgust.
With the threat gone, what's your plan for shutting everything down? Sarge asked, trying to change the topic.
I've got orders to move back to the armory, so that's what we're going to do, Sheffield replied.
What about for releasing the civilians? What's your plan for them?
Sheffield looked at the camp. We'll do it in waves. You know my feelings on the issue. Try to be as humane as possible. I don't think now is the time for us to be abandoning people. If there ever was a time for us to be assisting the citizens of this country, it's now.
If it were like Katrina, isolated in scope, then I would agree. But this is the entire country. It's everyone, and the full might of the combined branches of all services couldn't make a dent in this, Sarge replied.
I hate to say it, Cap, but he's right, Livingston added.
It just feels to me like we're running out on people, Sheffield replied tiredly.
Then take comfort in the fact that it's not your decision, Livingston said.
Sheffield looked at him. And live with the fact that I'm essentially throwing people out to their deaths? It just doesn't seem right to me. I don't want that on my conscience.
Captain, be realistic. How long do you think you can take care of them if you try? How long can you feed them and your people? What if more people arrive and want to come in? You're looking at a headache of management at the least, a full-blown crisis or mutiny if it continues. And those civilians before, you think they were aligned with DHS?
Better to shut it down, Sarge said.
Sheffield shifted on his feet. The decision has been made. We're heading back into town.
That'd be a good idea.
Get you closer to the community. Offer protection.
There's a lot of badness coming our way soon, Sarge added.
Sheffield raised his eyebrows. What do you mean?
Where are you from, Captain? Sarge drawled.
I'm from upstate New York. Been down here for a couple of years. Why?
Then you probably haven't been able to experience the best of our hurricane season, my friend. Another couple of months, it's going to kick off. Maybe we'll get lucky. Maybe we'll get hit. Hell, in 04 they played a game of pinata with us.
The last thing we need is a damn hurricane, Sheffield said, scratching his head. Even over the time period Sarge had known him, the captain looked like he had aged years. We wouldn't even have any warning, would we? He said, sounding exhausted.
Not sure what kind of satellite resources the boys upstairs at MacDill have. They may be able to give us a warning, but I wouldn't count on it.
Sheffield paced around. You bring up some good points. I need to talk to Livingston about how this will all play out. We need to weigh out the needs of who is here versus the needs of the community. I don't want to just abandon these folks. I want to give them as much of a chance as we can. Sarge leaned back and put his hands behind his head.
I didn't say it would be easy, but you gotta watch out for your own hide. Just take it from me.
As they were finishing up their chat, Livingston pulled up in front of the Hummer with Kay in tow. She looked up at Sarge.
Well, hi, Linus. Nice to see you again.
The old man smiled.
Good to see you too, Miss Kay.
She smiled and looked at Sheffield. Captain, what can I do for you?
First, some good news. The boys from the Frostproof camp came with some supplies.
I want you to look it over and give me an idea of what it will do for us, how long it will last.
Well, how many people do we have here now that the DHS are gone? Kay asked.
Sheffield looked at Livingston.
Last count was 217 civilians. But some leave every day, it seems, plus our people. We're currently just shy of 100, including dependents.
Kay looked at the stack of boxes. They had various labels on them. Mountain House, Thrive, and several others. All contained cans of various freeze-dried foods. Kay squinted and let out a long exhale.
Even with this,
we're really going to be stretching it.
There's just so many mouths to feed, Kay said.
I'm trying to do my best. I've already cut back to 2 meals a day, but I don't know how long we can hold out with what's on hand, plus this.
We might get 2 weeks if we're feeding everyone.
She paused and timidly asked,
What is the government doing with this stuff?
It looks civilian.
The DHS went on a spending spree a couple of years ago, stocking up on freeze-dried food and ammo, Sarge replied. It was all over the place. I followed a lot of alternative news, but it got so bad it actually made it into the mainstream media, though they didn't do much with it.
Oh, I never heard about that. Why would they do that, though? Kay asked.
Sarge held his arms out and spun around.
Look around. What do you think?
Surprised, Kay asked, You think they knew this was coming?
Knew? Hell, I think they were in on it.
Sheffield stared at the boxes, then rubbed his temples.
2 weeks.
This was so much more than he had bargained for. He was fine with taking care of his unit. He could depend on them, and for the most part, they took orders and pitched in. But these civilians were a different story. There were just so many of them, and many offered little effort in the maintenance of their own lives. It made for a heavy burden. Sheffield rubbed his chin.
LT, join me in my office.
Sheffield fell into the chair behind the desk and let out a long breath. Livingston took a seat across from him.
What's on your mind?
I don't know how to do this. I mean, how do we tell these people?
I guess we just tell them like it is.
They've got to move on.
Tell them that right now we're just not in a position to support them.
Why did they send us in here to do this?
What was the point of taking over the camp just to leave it? Sheffield asked.
Livingston laughed.
For the same reason we'd take cities in Iraq, only to leave them. Remember, military intelligence is an oxymoron.
I wish MacDill would give me more info.
If I knew what was going on, it would really help.
All we can do is act in the orders we have, like it or not.
Get all the squad leaders in here so we can brief them. They need to know what's going on, Sheffield said.
Livingston nodded and left the office. Seeing him leave, Sarge stuck his head in the door.
What's the plan, Captain?
Sheffield rubbed his face. This was really wearing on him. We're going to brief the squad leaders, give them time to get their people up to speed. Then I'll address the camp. Sarge nodded.
Good deal. I know you don't like it, but the sooner we deal with this, the better.
Sheffield nodded. Let's go over to the conference room. They should start showing up pretty quick. Once all the NCOs were accounted for, Sheffield stood up.
All right, listen up. Some things have changed, and you guys need to be aware of them. We're now in regular contact with command at MacDill in Tampa.
This wasn't news to many of the assembled. The rumor mill was fast and efficient.
We've been ordered to close the camp. We're relocating back to the armory, and before you ask, no, I don't know why.
In a little while, after you've had time to inform your people, I'll address the camp and let the refugees know we're leaving.
Why do we even bother with this then? Perez asked.
Because we had orders.
Now we have new ones. I don't make them up, and I don't know any more than I've just told you.
We were ordered back to the armory and are to await further orders. A staff sergeant in the back of the room called out.
What are we supposed to do with all these people?
As much as I hate to say this, it's not our problem.
The statement stirred those assembled, and they began talking among themselves. Sheffield raised his voice and continued.
MacDill is of the opinion that these folks are in the same position as everyone else. Nowadays, everyone is essentially a refugee, and we are no longer in the refugee business. I don't like it any more than you do, but we have orders, and we will carry them out.
Sheffield paused.
and there were no comments. I'll give you 30 minutes to let your people know before I address the refugees. Get to it. The squad leaders quickly got to their feet and left the room. Sheffield looked over at Sarge, and the old man nodded his approval.
All right, LT, call them together for an address.
We're going to start putting them out. Let's go through the gear we have and see how we can equip them. I don't want to send them out with nothing.
What about weapons? You know they're going to ask, Livingston asked.
Sheffield looked at him.
Okay, but only what we retained from when the DHS did their sweeps of the civilians. No military-grade hardware, and do something with that body, he added, referring to Singer's corpse.
Roger that, boss,
Livingston replied, and headed off to make an announcement to the camp.
Have you sent anyone out to the armory yet, to check on it? Sarge asked.
No, we only got the orders this morning, but we need to. As soon as this address is over, we'll get a patrol down there.
You look like shit, Jamie, Ian said with a smile.
Doc had moved her back to the barracks and was examining her more closely there.
Jamie turned her head. Her left eye was nearly swollen shut, and her lip was likewise inflated.
She did indeed look like shit.
Go to hell, Ian, she said through gritted teeth.
Doc checked her ears and eyes, trying to raise the lid of the left eye to check her pupils. While it looked bad, Doc pronounced that she wasn't in any immediate danger.
You'll be sore and sport some trophies for a couple of weeks, but you'll be all right. Just take it slow for a while. I'll talk to the captain and tell him to go easy on you.
Jamie gave him a smile of thanks. She wasn't one to lie around and not pull her weight, but she knew she needed a little time to recover. Mike and Ted walked in. Ted gripped her shoulder.
How you doing, kid?
She simply nodded in response. Mike stepped up beside her and made a show of looking her over.
You know, I think you're a little young for plastic surgery.
Jamie swatted him with the back of her hand.
Get some rest. We'll watch out for you, Mike said,
giving her hand a squeeze. To his surprise, she squeezed back, holding it just a moment longer. Ted's radio crackled, and Sarge's voice filled the air.
Teddy, you and Mike meet me over at the command bunker.
Roger that, he replied, then looked at Mike.
Let's go.
Mike looked at Jamie.
I'll check on you later.
Mike and Ted walked out to the Hummer. They got in, and before Ted started it up, he looked at Mike. Mike looked over.
What? You finally making a little headway with her?
Mike rolled his eyes.
Shut up and drive.
As Ted pressed the starter, he smiled and began to sing.
Jamie and Mike, sitting in a tree. K-I-S-S-I-N-G.
Mike looked at him. What are you, four? Ted let out an uproarious laugh and floored the truck, tossing a spray of sand into the air. At the command bunker, they got out and found Sarge.
What's up, boss?
Sarge pointed at Sheffield.
Captain here is about to make an announcement that some of these folks aren't going to like. I want you to go to the armory and get out some of the less lethal goodies in case they get out of hand.
Ted nodded as he and Mike started walking toward the bunker that contained all the things that go bang. A guardsman was standing watch in front of it. He smiled and nodded as they approached.
You guys my relief?
Sorry, man, we're not. We just need some stuff.
Damn, he replied, as he opened the padlock on the door. Inside, the two guys hung tear gas grenades on their body armor and filled their pockets with more. Mike grabbed a shotgun from a ready rack and looked around for the less lethal shells. Finding them, he loaded the Remington 870 and opened the dump pouch on his belt and emptied several boxes of shells into it. Ted took another shotgun and did the same.
See anything else we need? Ted asked.
Nah, I think this'll do it, Mike replied.
As they emerged from the bunker, the guard asked,
What's with that stuff? What's going on?
They're about to make an announcement, telling the folks here they ain't gotta go home, but they can't stay here anymore, Mike said.
No shit.
I was just told but didn't believe it. Guess it's legit.
Looks like it. Keep an eye on this place. Some of them might get some bright ideas.
I'll have another one or two sent over here to back you up, Ted replied.
Great. And tell them to bring some water, too. I'm dying out here.
Ted nodded, and he and Mike headed back to the command bunker. As they walked, the PA system in the camp announced itself with a high-pitched squeal. Livingston's voice quickly followed, telling the refugees in the camp to assemble for an address from the camp commander.
Hey, what's going on? A man asked Ted.
I don't know. Guess we'll all find out, Ted replied.
Hey, when's lunch going to be served today? There wasn't any breakfast, a woman said.
Don't know about that one either.
This is bullshit, a third added. Mike and Ted shrugged in response.
Once out of earshot, Mike said, Oh boy, this is going to be interesting.
You think?
Back at the command bunker, Ted approached Sheffield.
Hey Cap, there's only one guard on the armory. It might be a good idea to send a couple more over there, in case these folks get any ideas.
Sheffield told Ian to take care of it. Ian nodded and walked off to find a couple of volunteers.
Looks like they're gathering up, Captain. You ready? Sarge asked.
Sheffield nodded, a hint of nervousness on his face.
Just tell them like it is, remember that. You've got orders to close the camp.
They've got to start taking care of themselves like the rest of the country is. It is what it is.
Sheffield stood up straighter, like he got a shot of confidence.
Exactly. They're not the only ones. We're all refugees now.
Times, they are a-changin'.
Sheffield let out a long breath and headed out to face the assembled crowd. Mike and Ted took up positions, flanking the captain on either side. Livingston handed Sheffield a mic as the crowd continued to build. Scanning the crowd as the last of the civilians trickled in, Sheffield began.
Thank you for giving me your time. As I hope most of you know, I am Captain Sheffield of the Florida National Guard. I am truly troubled by what I'm about to tell you.
He paused for a moment to gauge the crowd, noting the sideways whispers and furtive glances to one another.
We are no longer in a position to provide for you. We have been ordered by the upper levels of our command to close the camp. We are currently inventorying the supplies of the camp, and we'll provide you as much as we can.
Suddenly, the nervous crowd became animated, seemingly vibrating with action as people moved about, talking to one another. From the crowd, a man's voice shouted the question,
What does that mean to us?
Sheffield took a deep breath.
It means you're going to have to leave.
The crowd erupted in shouts and cries. The reaction of the adults scared several of the children in the assembly, and soon they were crying, adding to the commotion.
I know this is a scary thing. Believe me, we understand.
But there is not enough food here, and there simply isn't anything we can scavenge from the surrounding area. If you stay here, you'll simply starve. A man burst forth from the crowd and raised an accusatory finger at Sheffield.
Why did you do this? Why are you here if you can't take care of us? At least the DHS fed us.
There were shouts of agreement from the crowd, as well as accusations.
You just want to keep the food for yourselves, a woman shouted from the crowd. You said you were here to protect us. What are we supposed to do?
A woman cried out, her voice cracking.
We didn't ask for you to save us, a man shouted in a sneer. Now you're going to kill us all.
In an attempt to keep things from getting worse, Sheffield offered them support.
Look, we're not going to just send you down the road. We'll provide you with equipment, what food we can, and some weapons so you can defend yourselves.
For some in the crowd, hearing weapons got their attention.
Weapons? What sort of weapons? A man called out.
We have a collection of confiscated weapons that we'll hand out, with as much ammo as there is for them, Sheffield replied.
Hell, if you give me a gun, I'll leave now.
I say we just stay here. They can't make us leave, another shouted.
Screw that. Let's just take what we want and get out of here, a man shouted.
This isn't going to deteriorate into a riot. You're not going to loot this camp. We will organize the distribution of supplies, and weapons will be distributed at the gate on your way out. Anyone who tries to take anything will be dealt with accordingly. The fact is, we can no longer stay here. The camp is closing. My people are pulling out as well, Sheffield announced.
If you're leaving, then why can't we stay?
Take your shit and go. We'll stay here, a burly man shouted, then added,
Who's with me?
The crowd erupted in shouts and applause. Sheffield looked at Sarge questioningly, and Sarge simply shrugged his shoulders. Turning back to the crowd, Sheffield asked,
How do you intend to provide for yourselves?
We have brought in water, and the food supply here will last 2 weeks, tops. How will you survive out here?
Don't worry about us. Just get out.
Leave us the tents and other equipment you offered, and let us sort it out, the man shouted back. Sheffield turned to Livingston, putting his hand over the mic.
What do you think?
He shrugged. We need to organize some things for those who want to go, but as for the rest, it's their death wish. Sheffield turned back to the crowd. I'll consult with my staff about you staying here. If we agree to it, we'll leave you as much as we can in the way of supplies, but you've got to understand there isn't anything around here for you in terms of food.
Let us worry about that,
the man at the front of the crowd replied, venom in his voice. Sheffield motioned for the man to step forward. Pulling him off to the side, he said, I'll work with you in this transition. Get whoever wants to stay together and decide who's in charge. I'll deal with one or two of you, but I'm not going to have hundreds of people shouting demands at me. The man nodded his approval. But that means I will also hold whoever is selected accountable for the actions of the people here. The man nodded again, and Sheffield stuck out his hand. What's your name?
Neil Baker,
the man said, as he shook Sheffield's hand. All right, Neil. I'll get with you later today. Where do you live?
1037. Ask anyone around and they'll know where to find me.
Sheffield nodded.
I'll find you later to discuss the transition.
Neil nodded and walked back to the crowd, which parted as if he were Moses and they were the sea. Sarge walked up beside Sheffield.
You better keep an eye on that one, Captain.
Without looking over, Sheffield replied. I told him whoever they select to represent their interests is accountable for the actions of the people here in the camp until we leave.
I've got a feeling this isn't going to be as easy as you think.
Sheffield looked over. What else can I do? If they want to stay, who am I to make them leave? He paused and looked at the departing crowd. They just don't understand what they're getting into.
Some lessons have to be learned the hard way.
Livingston snorted.
They're about to get a hell of an education.
Amen, LT. Now, let's get a patrol headed toward the armory. I need to get more details about its condition, ASAP. Chapter 5. Tyler and I made the trip back to the house as fast as we could, practically jogging. As was now the custom, everyone was at Danny's place as it was getting on to supper time. I told them about meeting Jenna and Dylan and the trade I was about to make. Danny, in particular, was impressed.
Mead? Why you holding out on us, brother?
I just got it. Can't a man have a drink? Sheesh. We passed the bottles of mead around. It was a big hit. Everyone was commenting on the unique flavors.
Can I try some, Dad? Taylor asked.
Mel swatted at her.
Just because there's no laws here right now doesn't mean you're allowed to be drinking in my household.
Jess was taking a sip from one of the bottles. Mary was watching her closely. Lowering the bottle, Jess wiped a small trickle running down her chin. She held the bottle out.
Want some?
Mary smiled. You know I don't drink. Fred grabbed the bottle and took a long tug and stuck it in Mary's lap. Girl, right now you could use a drink, trust me. Mary looked at the bottle for a moment before taking a timid sip. As she did, Fred reached over and lifted the bottom of the bottle. Mary's eyes grew wide as the honey-flavored liquor flowed into her mouth. Fred and Jess started to laugh as Mary's cheeks were swollen like a chipmunk hoarding nuts. After a couple of swallows, she held the bottle out and looked at it. That's really good, she finally said, and turned it up to take another. When she lowered the bottle, Fred took it from her. Careful, it'll sneak up on you, she said, then took another drink herself and passed it to Jeff. Jeff smiled. Let me show you how to do this. He turned the bottle up like a professional drinker. Thad rolled his eyes and grabbed the bottle, wrenching it from Jeff's hand, spilling a little down his shirt. You ain't the only one who needs a drink around here, he said, with a smile, before taking a drink himself. As I filled a baggie with kudzu flour, I talked about the beautiful greenhouse that Jenna kept, with all the fruits and veggies growing in it. Thad was really interested in the greenhouse and said he wanted to go back with me. Brandy volunteered to cook in his place, and Mel and Bobby jumped in to offer assistance as well. Mary raised a hand. I'd like to help too. Mel smiled. The more the merrier. Come on. The ladies disappeared into the kitchen. As I moved around the kitchen, gathering what we needed to trade, I asked Eric how he was feeling. Useless, he replied. How's the shoulder? It's all right. I just feel like a mooch not doing anything, Eric replied, staring at the floor. Don't sweat it, man. You're still healing. There'll be plenty for you to do when you're back up to speed, Danny said. I nodded and patted him on the back. You'll be back in fighting shape in no time. As the women sorted out dinner, I knew it was time to make our exit. You ready, Thad?
Yeah, I got the liver. Did you get the salt?
I did. And hey, do me a favor and grab them some of the mullet, too. Thad took a plastic shopping bag and put a few handfuls of the smoked fish in it. Once that was done, we went and climbed on the ATVs to make the trip as fast as possible. Jenna and Dylan were still sitting on the front porch when we returned. I introduced Thad to the couple.
Good to meet you, Dylan said. And you and the missus, too, Thad replied.
Morgan, we were talking while you were gone. A few weeks ago, we heard a lot of shooting out that way, she said, pointing her arm toward the direction of our neighborhood. Was that you guys? Jenna asked.
About a month and a half ago? Yep, that was probably us, I replied. Well, glad to see you guys made it through, Dylan said.
We were getting visits from some local goons the DHS were using. When we fended them off, the feds decided we weren't getting the hint and paid us a visit personally. How have you guys managed to stay hidden so long? Thad asked.
Oh, we haven't been totally hidden. We've had our share of visitors, Jenna answered.
What'd you do when they arrived? I asked.
Oh, I've got the answer for most folks. Got this big-ass sword in the house. It's a cheap piece of junk, but looks badass, Dylan said. You scared them off with a sword? Thad asked, eyebrows raised.
Yeah. If he was running at you naked with a big-ass sword, wouldn't you run? Jenna asked, trying not to laugh. I thought about it for a minute, then a smile started to spread across my face. Yeah, guess I would. People are scared of two things, crazy people and naked people. Add them together and it scares the shit out of folks. Plus, if they think you're nuts, they think you ain't got nothing, Dylan said. Thad and I both busted out laughing.
I guess so, I replied.
But how did you avoid the feds?
Oh, they sent one of their mailmen around once, Dylan said with a grin. What happened? Thad asked.
Batman buried him under the compost pile.
He tried to tell us we had to move, and that we were going to be taken to different places. Batman told him that wasn't going to happen, and he told us, with some colorful language, that we would go where we were told.
That didn't sit well with Batman, Jenna answered.
Sit well? Pissed me right off. I got the feeling that if he made it back to wherever he was going, we'd have trouble.
He didn't make it back to wherever, Dylan said.
Jenna asked me, did you guys ever run into any? Wanting you to register or some such thing?
Nope. And guessing on the outcome, he came here first.
My answer got a laugh out of Dylan and Jenna.
What about you, Thad?
You ever see one? Dylan asked.
Yeah, I encountered one. Fed him to the hogs.
Dylan smiled.
Hogs gotta eat too.
That they do. And speaking of food, we brought you some smoked mullet too, Thad said, holding the bag. It was clear he wanted to change the subject, not wanting to further discuss the painful memories of that day.
Oh, that's great. I'll make a dip out of it, Jenna said as she took the bag.
I held up the flour.
Brought you some kudzu flour, too. You can use it to dust the liver before you cook it, or to thicken stews, that sort of thing.
Dylan took the bag.
Did you say kudzu flour? He asked, looking suspiciously into the bag.
Oh, yeah. You can eat all parts of it, except for the little tubers that grow above ground, I replied. With a look of surprise on his face, he said,
No shit? I didn't know that.
I went on to tell them about making chips out of the tender leaves and how the flowers were also edible. Once we'd made our exchange, Dylan went into the house and returned with several large sacks, stuffed full.
Oh, wow, Thad said as he took them. That's a lot of groceries.
Don't worry, we got plenty. I also put some honeycomb in there for the little ones. He didn't say how many there were, but it should be plenty, Jenna said. Thad looked up, his eyes wide.
Oh, I like me some honeycomb, he said, rubbing his hands together.
Jenna squinted an eye, and, pointing at him, she replied,
Now, those honeycombs are for them little ones, Thad.
A big grin spread across his face.
Yes, ma'am. Maybe next time.
That's better. Turning back to me, she pulled a small vial out of her pocket. Here's the medicine. We thanked them for everything, making plans to drop in on each other. Jenna said she didn't like to leave the house, but maybe Dylan could come by for a visit. I told them we would bring meat over whenever we had it, and how much I appreciated the trade. In my mind, we certainly got the better end of the deal. They assured us they were very happy with the trade. Having not had any meat in a while, they were really looking forward to the liver.
It's going to be dark soon. We'll see you guys later, I said, and they agreed.
Thad and I waved as we fired up the ATVs. As we pulled out onto the road, we both stopped instantly. A large group of people were walking down the road like a herd of cows. They took up both lanes as they approached.
We won't make it to the turnoff before they do, Thad said. I was nodding my head. I was thinking the same thing. I damn sure don't want them to see us turn off there. I don't think they've seen us yet. They sure don't act like it.
Let's just head that direction. We'll go past our road and turn into the woods. Come in the back way, I said. Thad adjusted the shotgun in his lap.
All right. He looked over at my rifle. That thing ready?
I checked the safety.
Yeah, but I sure hope it doesn't come to that.
There's a hell of a lot more of them than there are of us. Thad was correct that they didn't see us initially, because it was obvious when they did. The men in the group ran to the front, with the women and a handful of kids behind them.
They see us now, I said.
Yeah, they do. Let's just keep moving. The group had stopped, almost in front of our road. We approached them slowly, trying not to look intimidating. I was now really regretting the slight buzz the liquor had given me. As we drew near,
Several of the men shouldered their weapons. While not pointed directly at us, the message was clear. We stopped 50 or so feet from them. I raised one of my hands.
"We don't mean no harm."
The men looked at one another and to the side of the road. They were clearly nervous. One of them finally spoke up.
"We're just passing through."
"So are we," Thad replied.
Another of the group stepped forward.
"How is it you got gas for them four-wheelers?"
"All we have is what's in them. When they run dry, they'll sit where they stop," I replied.
"Just a little lie."
"Well, what's so important that you would use the last of your gas for it?"
Thad looked at me. He was holding the bag of veggies on his lap, and it gave me an idea.
"We went to the market in town for a little trading."
The men exchanged words that we couldn't hear. Then the one questioning us spoke again.
"Where is this market?"
"It's in Eustis," I said, jabbing a thumb over my shoulder to the south.
"What'd you trade for?"
Thad answered before I could.
"I don't think that much matters."
The man pointed behind him.
"We got hungry young'uns here. We need food."
"We can relate. So do we,"
Thad replied. The man looked around.
"Where y'all stay at?"
"That doesn't matter either," I said.
"I reckon it does. You want past us.
There's more of us than there is of you. And if you want by, you'll have to give us the food you've got." One of the women came forward and pulled on his sleeve. She said something to him, and he pushed her away.
"We can't do that either. We don't have much, and we have families too,"
Thad replied evenly.
"All I'm asking for is some food."
He hesitated for a moment, then his demeanor changed. He became very animated and gripped his rifle in front of him and started shouting.
"Or we can just take your food and your wheelers."
Thad muttered, "Oh, shit." "Yeah, that's what I was thinking," I replied. Our lack of immediate reply seemed to annoy him even more.
"Well, what's it going to be?"
"Look, we don't want any trouble. We already told you that. You go your way, and we'll go ours. When you get to Eustis, you can trade for food there," I replied.
"Trade? What the hell you think we got to trade? You ain't getting past me till you give it up."
"This ain't working," Thad whispered.
"I know.
Let's try it a different way," I whispered back, then stood up on the footrests.
"No. Plain and simple. No." The words seemed to stun the man as though he were physically struck by them. He looked at the men to his side, then back at us. Just as he was about to speak, I quickly raised my carbine and started to shout at the top of my lungs in a maniacal tone.
"There may be more of you than there are of us, but guarantee you one thing, you will be the first to die. Bullets don't discriminate, and them young'uns behind you will probably be hit by the rounds that pass through your worthless ass. Someone will be burying your kids tonight."
The men with him took a step back, looking at one another uncertainly. The man I was addressing stood there, as if turning the statement over in his mind. The woman who had tugged on his sleeve earlier now ran forward and pulled at him, obviously pleading with him. His eyes stayed fixed on me with an expression I couldn't quite make out. I wanted this resolved. We weren't getting anywhere standing in the middle of the road.
"What's it going to be?"
I shouted.
"There's only two things stopping you right now. Fear and common sense, and somehow, I don't think you got much in the way of sense, common or otherwise."
One of the other men with him held up a hand.
"Look, mister, we don't want no trouble. He's just wore out."
He swept his hand at the crowd behind him.
"We all are."
"Then be on your way.
We'll pull off the road here and let you pass, like I originally said."
The man nodded, and Thad and I pulled off the road, turning so we were facing it. The group started to move, making their way to the far side of the paved strip.
I can't believe that worked, Thad whispered.
I gave a little laugh while keeping my eyes on the group.
Tell me about it.
Guess what old Dylan said about crazy people was right. I heard Thad snort and chanced a quick glance at him. Even though he had a hand up over his face, I could still see his grin.
What?
I asked. Trying to stifle his laughter, he replied,
I'm just glad you didn't get naked.
Despite the tension of the moment, it was all I could do not to start laughing. I would have been okay, too, if Thad hadn't looked at me from between his fingers. I could see tears on his cheeks. I could only imagine what these people thought of us as they came closer. Thad with his face in his hands, me